Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Censored. I'm Aoife Vrednach, a historian reading salacious texts. This is season 7 of the podcast, and what a long way we've come. 64 episodes on the best and worst of the Irish censors blacklist. From Jack Kerouac to Jackie Collins, I've read every genre of blacklisted novel. But I wanted to expand my remit a bit, because the censors I've talked about could only ban publications. If it wasn't a printed book or magazine, they weren't interested. Because, of course, the Censorship of Publications Board was an arm of the state, its powers were defined in law. So the board had no power to restrict spoken speech or visual art exhibitions or theatre. Technically, there were whole swathes of Irish life where anything could be said or done, where formal limits did not apply. Of course, we know that wasn't true, because state censorship wasn't the only mechanism restricting expression. That's why this season I'm looking at censorship's older sister, censure. I'm leaving government prohibition orders to one side and exploring how ordinary, apparently decent people censured each other. Sometimes it's as dramatic as a book burning, other times it manifests as strongly worded letters to newspaper editors. Versions of censure today, you could argue, include cancel culture and, before that, in the 90s, political correctness. Just so you know, I'm not doing a podcast on cancel culture, because there are much better pods out there on that topic already. Check out Cancel Me Daddy if you want contemporary hot takes. I want to do something quite specific in this season. I want to look at how Irish people who were not state censors limited forms of expression. I'm interested in the ways censure limits who is seen and heard. I think often of something one of the film censors said in 1943. There are at least 1 million censors in Ireland. I am only the official censor. So for this season, I want to restrict the meaning of the word censorship to that formal, bureaucratic, state-led stuff and talk about social censure instead. In this first episode, I'm examining the Playboy riots of 1907, an infamous clash between a theatre and an audience who denounced a play by heckling, stamping, pounding the seats with sticks, and generally acting the maggot. The play in question was The Playboy of the Western World by John Millington Synge, and it all happened in January 1907 in Dublin's Abbey Theatre. The standard interpretation of this almost week-long rouille-le-bouille is that a daring, sexually frank play offended nationalist Holy Joes so much that they rioted. It seems to ominously prefigure formal state-led censorship, the sort of stuff I've been talking about all along. You could argue that the historical origins of a culture of taking offence emerged in the Playboy riots. It looks like a sexually repressive, prudish Ireland made her spectacular debut in the Abbey Theatre that week. Or rather, his debut, because the Playboy riots have an extremely strong macho energy. I'm just going to summarise the plot of the Playboy very briefly here. Christie is the Playboy. He kills his da, goes on the run, confesses to the crime, and becomes the local stud. All the girls and women in the play fawn on him. Peggy Mike dumps her fiancé so she can be free to marry Christy. The widow Quinn is all over him like a rash. Two other single young women flirt outrageously with him. He tells his story of splitting his father open with a shovel more than once, revelling in the attention. Unfortunately for Christy, the plot twist is that Da is not dead. The desperate young fella tries to kill him again and fails again because you just can't kill the patriarchy. All the girls are pure disgusted that he's not the father-killing hero of their dreams, so he gets a fierce slagging off. At the very end, Christy and the unkillable Da leave together, somewhat reconciled. Peggy and Mike ends the play with the famous line, "Oh my grief, I've lost him surely. I've lost the only playboy of the Western world." I've done a two-part deep dive on this. Firstly, I'm going to analyse the play and then the riots. In this episode, I'm talking about the play itself, checking whether it contained offensive material and if it was saying anything provocative. Part two, on the riots themselves, is already up on Patreon if you're desperate to hear how it ends. Otherwise, you'll just have to wait till next week. To explore the Playboy riots, I'm joined by Dr. Lloyd Maeve Houston from the University of Alberta, where they are Banting Postdoctoral Fellow. And they've graced the podcast before, rating the filth of both James Joyce and Samuel Beckett. So check out those past episodes too. Hi Lloyd, welcome to the podcast again.
You can't keep me away.
No, I mean, we're just going to have to bring you on as a rolling guest.
Yeah, so slowly becoming a permanent fixture.
And so we're dealing with the Playboy this time, which I'm really excited about because I didn't like seeing much, but I watched this and I'm kind of a bit of a convert now. I'm impressed.
Fabulous. I'm so very glad. It's I definitely remember, you know, when I was growing up, like finding it kind of infuriating how like ubiquitous that play was and how, you know, it seemed like Irish drama was reducible to this one play and one controversy. But like by the time I kind of came to study it in depth, I was like, nah, it's actually quite good.
Yeah.
Frustratingly satisfying experience with a lot of layers to it.
Yeah. So the drink to go with the play or the riot, actually, I suppose you could say both. I was thinking spirits because Peggy always seems to be doling out shots to everybody.
Yeah, I think it's a play through which a fair amount of like potchy. I mean, it's, you know, it's set in a shebeen, right? It is literally, you know, kind of drink is permanently within arm's reach. And then you've also got even sort of off stage, Peggy's da kind of heads out to and rolls in from awake, where we're told you'd never see the match of it for flows of drink, the way when we sunk her bones at noonday in her narrow grave, there was five men, aye, and six men stretched out wretched and speechless on the holy stones.
A classic image of a really good Irish funeral, isn't it?
Well, see, no, I mean, Singh loves boozy wakes. Like he, in the Aran Islands as well, he sort of documents funeral culture and just how like rowdy it gets. So it's definitely something that he's very, very alive to and invested in.
So with our spirits in hand, we shall turn and do censorship bingo. Normally I do censorship bingo at the end, but I kind of feel this time we have to talk about the content of the text a bit before we get to the riots.
Yes, I think that's it's worth knowing in advance what irks people about this, because there's a fair amount. Although actually, I think it's also an interesting one, because in some ways, like censorship bingo, I think this will expose to some extent the difference that like form makes as well, right? Like what is acceptable or unacceptable on stage is different, I think, from what flies in print. Mm. As much as like similar kind of, you know, anxieties animate both, and I think this is possibly where your sort of censored versus censured distinction can become quite interesting. But yeah, so I mean, well, which ones did you spot, or do you want me to kind of start off? Or?
Well, I thought surely there was breasts in it, but then I was like, were there? I don't think so.
Well, there are. They are alluded to. There,
there's lots of fine figures of ladies, you know, like lovely girls. If you want a lovely girls competition, there's a good one happening.
Sure,
here.
They're all lovely girls. No, absolutely. I mean, we'll talk more about, I think, just the kind of like sexual vivacity of the women and how much of a problem that poses. But So certainly no one's like getting their tits out on stage or anything. I think.
God, that, can you imagine?
wardrobe malfunctions, fortunately, avoided in that initial run. But I think breasts and what happens with them is a kind of area of concern, and it's not even something that like seems to get picked up much in the sort of media response to it. But to my mind, is one of the most scandalous things about the play. So. There's a point kind of in the first act where the Widow Quinn has sort of come to keep an eye on Christian Pegeen at the invitation of Sean Keogh and Father Riley. And Pegeen is irked by this. And in order to sort of get the Widow Quinn out of the way, she talks about tries to kind of put Christy off. The Widow Quinn by saying, "Doesn't the world know you reared a black lamb at your own breast so that the Lord Bishop of Connaught felt the elements of a Christian and he eaten it after in a kidney stew?" On the one hand, the image of a woman who is, it's heavily, well, not even heavenly blind, just openly stated has murdered her husband, who the image of her like suckling a lamb at her own breast is already sort of boundary transgressing enough, but then the way that that's inserted into a kind of community so insular that like the Bishop of Connaught is brought into like very close proximity to her breast kind of metonymically through the lamb that he eats, and then this kind of this like disquieting sense of everything being kind of insular and interconnected then picks up, because there's a sort of point slightly later in that conversation where the Widow Quinn sort of hits back by saying, or, you know, tries to kind of put Christy off Pegeen by saying, well, you know, she's waiting only on a sheepskin parchment to be wed with Sean Keogh of Killikeen. So this is sort of like...
More sheep again.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's the same sheep, but it's like this sort of odd sense that, like, you've got this kind of line of connections from her breast through to, like, this... impending marriage between Sean and Pegeen, which we'll also talk about because it's also quite objectionable. Or I guess maybe we can just talk about it now, which is that it's not on the censorship bingo card.
Have incest, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, sometimes I've been like, why didn't I think of putting that on it? Because it turns out it's quite a thing.
Yeah, well, it's incest and inbreeding is, again, it's not something that's like heavily foregrounded in the scandalized response to the play, but to my mind, it's a kind of disquieting thing, or I think it's definitely like in the background of what makes the play so sort of irksome to the people who kind of protest it. So very early on, before Christie's sort of arrived in the shebang, we have this conversation between Sean and Pegeen where. They're discussing their forthcoming nuptials, and he says, "Aren't we after making a good bargain, the way we're only waiting these days on Father Riley's dispensation from the bishops of the court of Rome?" So obviously, like, no one these days is likely to enjoy hearing their impending marriage described as like a good bargain, and that kind of like, you know, that kind of commercial element.
Yeah,
I mean, it obviously we're a long way from sex work, but that sense of like, you know, relationships being governed by kind of financial interest.
These kind of arranged marriage kind of ideas.
Yes, which you know, if you look at the sort of demographic data, like was a feature of Irish, like post-famine Irish kind of marital patterns are really dictated by, you know, keeping a hold of land, consolidating property, and produce these marriages between like crusty old men and very young, you know, relatively speaking, young women. But if you sort of move past that, you know, the way that like the local priest and the Vatican are determining what the marriage, again, seems a bit suspect. But maybe to a modern ear, we might miss quite what's being signaled here. So beyond just, you know, the mercenary character of the relationship and Sean's undue deference to the church, we've also got the need for a papal dispensation. And I think for a Catholic audience of that day, that would have been a big red flag.
Because they're first or second cousins, aren't they?
Yeah, the proposed union violates the prohibition against consanguineous marriage, which, if we turn to our copy of the Catholic Encyclopedia, which I know we all have to hand.
Of course, I mean, just behind me, yeah.
We find that consanguinity is a determinant impediment of marriage as far as the fourth degree of kinship inclusive. And the fourth degree, as you say, is, yeah, it's first cousins. So, yeah, I mean, you know, of like first degree of consanguinity, you got your parents and children, and then second is like siblings, grandparents, etc. So given that they're roughly the same age and they aren't siblings or whatever, it seems most likely that Sean and Begin are clearly like cousins.
Yeah.
And if we turn to either if you had the program in front of you in that first performance, or if you look at the kind of character listing in published editions, we'll see they're listed as second cousins. So Sean Keogh is her second cousin, although in some editions it is first cousin. And as I say, that kind of, you know, papal dispensation thing seems to position them even closer than maybe the printed material around the play is prepared to suggest. What Christie walks into is like a breeding pool that is seemingly so shallow that the only person that Pegeen can be kind of wed to is this thoroughly, you know, kind of unprepossessing and excessively sort of God-fearing member of her own extended family, who seems to be largely marrying her for monetary reasons. So the picture, you know, the picture the play kind of seems to paint of, you know, the marital prospects and sexual prospects of what is, I mean, we'll talk about the role of the West in, you know, the play and in the response to it. But, you know, in what is supposedly the kind of heartland of, you know, an uncontaminated, authentic Ireland, it's basically just to present them as like a bunch of, you know, inbred bumpkins practicing clerically sanctioned incest.
Yeah, and all of that, like, in literally the opening scenes of the play.
Yeah. So from the word go, it's, you know, Singh comes out swinging in terms of... And that incest sort of... It crops up in different ways a bit later on as well. So, like, Christie, whenever he's, you know, at several different points in the play, Christie, in these sort of rhetorical set-piece moments, like, explains why he killed his father. And we get slightly different versions of that story depending on the audience he's telling it to. But one version of the story he gives whenever he's talking to the widow Quinn and in their sort of seduction scene, he talks about how he kills his dad because his dad's trying to kind of hook him up with the widow Casey.
Oh, yeah, an arranged marriage, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, a walk in terror from beyond the hills, and she 25 years and 200 weights and 5 pounds in the weighing scales, with a limping leg on her and a blinded eye, and she a woman of noted misbehaviour with the old and young.
Oh, dear.
But the reason that he says he won't marry her is because when all knows, she did suckle me for 6 weeks when I came into the world.
Oh, no!
Yeah! So
she's his wet nurse.
Yeah. So, you know, and so Christie becomes a bit like that lamb at the breast of Widow Quinn. Like, it's, you know, it's a play that like proliferates these images of, like, you know, inappropriately proximate.
Yeah, everyone's just a bit too close to each other, aren't they? It's just like creepy.
Yeah. Yeah, and like unhealthy, you know. Singh is for a variety of reasons, both kind of like in terms of the broader, you know, scientific and medical context, but also just I think in his own kind of Singh has a sort of famously poor constitution. He's quite unwell throughout his life. He dies of Hodgkin's disease. He only learns relatively close to his death that that's actually what the issue is. But so he's kind of haunted. There are sort of fragments of his, he dabbles with writing an autobiography. And if you look at those sort of writings, he has this like painful awareness of being, you know, quote unquote, unhealthy or like unwell. And he's very conscious of the ways in which those conditions can be kind of inherited, like broadly speaking, medical science in that period is very invested in ideas of heredity, you know, with a kind of emerging Darwinian sort of inflection to that. And so Singh's very conscious of how, you know, sick parents produce sick offspring in this sort of language. And so it's a play in which, yeah, just all of this kind of sense of like everyone being too genetically close for comfort and too physically close
too
for comfort.
Too physically involved with each other. I mean, to marry your wet nurse is really... it's just gross.
so there's like a version of the way Christie presents himself. You know, his kind of father destroying is also like this big swing against almost kind of heredity or like the impositions of heredity. You know, he's swinging his lawyer about in a very sort of virile way that seems to suggest his, you know, his kind of iconoclastic sexual vitality, which seems to be part of what makes him such an appealing prospect.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, you know, I was going to put the Widow Quinn and the sheep under the bestiality heading. I was kind of like...
Yes, yeah.
You know, could it really go... Like, I know it's breastfeeding, but it's also... It's more transgressive than just... You know, it seems to be something kind of quite sexual. And I think we could probably take that one too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that's the other thing as well, right, is that it's a play that, as much as obviously it clearly doesn't fully succeed in this game, or maybe it succeeds only too well, it is partly just seems to be very kind of animated by a desire to like see what it can smuggle on stage. Yeah. And then produce an atmosphere that means that it's like it's half a joke, but it's not a joke, and it's sexual, but it's not.
No,
and
the, yes. You know,
the interplay of like undertone and overtone is, I mean, you know, delicious. Like it's really, it has a lot of fun, but it means that like, yeah, once you start drilling down to it, it's, you know, as much as the riots, quote unquote, do seem like this sort of prudish overreaction. Yeah, it's a weird place, actually. Like it's
I found it really quite compelling. And when I was watching it, I was like, I should be really annoyed by this because this excessive dialect thing can really get in my nerves. But I'm actually totally into it. You know, it sucks you in and it kind of does. There are so many suggestive moments where you go, hang on, no, maybe not. And it's gone. And then they're onto something else and you think, I'm not sure about that. But anyway, I'm here for the ride, so I'll just
no, hang absolutely. On. I think, I mean, it's also one of the things that, it's something that gets the play into trouble. I mean, we can maybe, you know, later kind of itemize exactly what seems to prompt the most stringent objections. But yeah, that sort of rhetorical exuberance and then it not quite being clear what's explicitly or implicitly being said combined with the increasing din that attends the play, like the play, you know, the longer the protests go on, the more inaudible the play becomes, the more people just kind of hear in it what they want to hear. Yeah. So there's a point where there's a moment where one of the actors has to like send a letter into one of the Dublin papers, I can't remember which, being like, I didn't say fucking on the, like, I said that's I've been grossly misquoted. He says, like, you know, dirty, I can't remember what it is, like, it's like dirty, it's something alliterative, but it, you can see how amid a room full of people stamping and playing bugles and screaming, yeah, that like it could be misheard, but it's
the perfect play really if you're dirty minded, I have to say, because you really will get a lot of filth out of it if you're prepared to consider it filthy in the first place. And the next one is sex work. Now, like, there is a lot of commercial relationships in, you know, in marriage and all of that, but is there actual any references to actual sex work?
No, not nothing is sort of formalized as that. I think it's a play that's like, and I think the response to it is sort of haunted more by the kinds of anxieties around like unmarried young women the sort of figure of the single girl as someone sort of, I guess, like proximate to sex work. Like, there's a whole sort of history here that you could dig into, but obviously, you know, I mean, Maria Luddy does excellent work around the history of sex work in Ireland, where she sort of teases out how a real figure of concern is the so-called sort of casual, yes, who is, you know, yeah, the amateur who, you know, kind of at moments of financial necessity may engage in sex work, but isn't, you know, that's not their sort of permanent source of income, and who exists in this sort of liminal space between respectability and its obverse. And it seems like, yeah, the ways in which, the eagerness with which all the women in this play respond to Christy, in like the surreal excitement that's generated.
It's really
by, like,
over the
you
top.
Killed your dad, like, oh yeah,
wow, he's hot, isn't he?
Yeah, that kind of exuberant sexual appetite, and that kind of framing of women as sort of sexual agents is obviously quite a distance from commercialized sex in some senses, but I think if we're trying to kind of triangulate it within the sort of cultural imaginary of Ireland in that period, I think that there's definitely like a continuum that exists there, yeah. But not a, yeah, and certainly, I mean, the Widow Quinn particularly is just very happy to be like, you know, look, right, come on out to my high scene, don't marry Pagin, she's a nightmare, but look, I'll put you up. Like, she's almost kind of employing him as like, yeah, kind of gigolo, like, you know.
Yeah, I'll feed and house you. You just need to hang out with me. It's great.
Yeah. Just, yeah.
So, yeah, you see, can we take it then, do you think? Is this part of the problem with the censorship bingo for a play like this? That it is quite suggestive and brings out a lot of themes, but doesn't actually, you know, nail its colours to the mast in the same way maybe a book would.
Yes, I think so. And I think part of its, the game it plays with its audience is that sort of proximity, or, you know, there is something kind of flirtatious about the way
it is. Actually, that is precisely what it does. And it teases the whole time.
No, absolutely, yeah. And it's, and you know, and you have like long passages in the play that are actually really concerned with that. Like the way that, like, I mean, you know, it's a play that's structurally oriented around a succession of seduction scenes, right? Like each act is almost the same narrative shape as the succeeding act. It just seems to go a little farther, or things, you know,
yes,
get taken more or less literally, with, you know, ultimately sort of catastrophic effect. But like when Christy arrives in the Shebeen, And is being really coy. Like, he does that, you know, there's this sort of rhetorical striptease about even what he's done.
Yeah.
Where, you know, everyone who's in the Shebeen is, like, having a guess. So it's like, you know, maybe he followed a young woman on a lonesome night and Chrissy's like, oh, saints forbid, mister, I was all times a decent lad. Maybe the land was grabbed from him and he did what any decent man would do. And, you know, and Christy's like, no, I'm too rich from that. You know, my dad was a strong farmer. Thank you very much. Did you strike golden guineas out of solder, young fellow? Or did you marry three wives, maybe? So, you know, it there's this constant sort of deliberate. Yeah, I think teasing is exactly the right word for it. Sort of play with, like, what Christy did or didn't do and, you know, what did or didn't happen. And even the kind of, like, you know, Schrodinger's parasite. is exactly this. You know, obviously Pagin famously says, you know, there's a great difference between a gallows story and a dirty deed done in your own backyard. But, like, the play exists in exactly the liminal space between those two things.
Yes.
And kind of flirts with collapsing that distinction, but also likes to keep it operative. Like, as the sort of the gap between the two spark plugs that lets everything crackle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I just can't believe how good it is, actually. I was not expecting to enjoy it quite this much. And I'm especially enjoying how it's collapsing censorship bingo so effectively. I think this is great fun. Just burn it. Just throw it out. I feel like it should nearly get, you know, the 15 out of 25 and 5 for extra teasing. It could really do a full house. So let's quickly then, do you want to just say what other ones really strike you out of the card then? Because I don't think there's, in a way, let's just abandon the concept of the card and just take something that really jumps out.
Yeah, I mean, well, I suppose it's there's a felt sense of obligation to acknowledge the what notionally precipitates all the ruckus, right? Yeah. So, you know, if anyone, I suppose, knows anything about this play, or I don't know if you were like a desperate kind of Leaving Cert student who had to like quote one word from it, you would always have the word shift ready
shift,
to hand,
yeah.
Right? Shift in the sense of a term for a woman's undergarment, not the sense of giving someone the shift.
Which for non-Irish people means snogging them.
Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, famously on the sort of Saturday night on which the play premieres, Lady Augusta Gregory, who's one of the heads of the sort of the Abbey, she sends two telegrams to W.B. Yeats, one kind of at the halfway point and the other at the conclusion of the show. Yeats is away in business. And the first one says, you know, play's a success. Audience are enjoying it. You know, it's getting laughs where it should, basically. But the second one is, audience broke up at word shift. What that is referring to is a moment late in the play after Christy has gone out, seemingly killed his father for a second time, and everyone's getting ready to either, well, turn him over to the authorities, stroke, extrajudicially hang him. Christy, is convinced that having killed his dad again, Pagin will once again sort of welcome him with open arms. He sort of refuses to leave, saying, it's Pagin I'm seeking only, and what did I care if you brought me a drift of chosen females standing in their shifts itself, maybe, from this place to the eastern world. So, you know, even if you presented me with
all the women in the world.
All in their underwear, from here to the horizon, I wouldn't move. Which is itself a kind of reference to, I think, something Hugh Holland says, like it's or like one of the his sort of heroic trials. So there is a kind of, you know, it's another instance of saying something very provocative, but in a way that actually has some kind of grounding in, or, you know, a notional justification. But this image of, you know, a streel of women in de facto lingerie proves notionally unacceptable. W.G. Fay, who played Christy in that first production, didn't help matters by flubbing the line. So instead of saying a drift of chosen females, he said a drift of Mayo girls, which made it, you know, more kind of concrete and situated in the real world. The slight difficulty with that is, as a kind of explanation of what goes on, is that actually the audience have been kind of losing their shit from earlier than this. So by the point that that Christie's da has reappeared on the scene, they've been kind of unsettled on that first night. And then by the time Christy goes out and lops his dad's head again. Basically from there, the audience, Ben Levitas, who's a sort of Irish theatre historian, he talks about how by that point, the kind of, in a way that Singh seems to have engineered, the mob violence on stage is mirrored by the kind of unrest in the audience. And there's this kind of deliberate breakdown between, you know, the fourth wall basically collapses at that point. And so the shift kind of reference is just the icing on the cake. In fact, actually, it seems like if you read the Freeman's Journal, which is that first their review of the play, or their first sort of account of the disturbances, they don't actually mention it because I don't think they hear it.
There's too much commotion, really.
However, well, but it's also that there are several shifts and references to two shifts that cause an issue. There's a clearly spurious letter from a Western, someone claiming to be a Western girl in the Freeman that's clearly just the same. Like, I mean, you know, in a debate that's all about like how Irish women are being ventriloquized, it's really funny that, you know, people keep ventriloquizing Irish women to like critique the play.
But, isn't it a Western girl too, as well?
Yeah.
What? It's more than one of ye pretending to be a Western girl. Fair enough.
But she says, this notional Western girl says in the Freeman's Journal, every character uses coarse expressions, and Miss Allgood, one of the most charming actresses I've ever seen, is forced, before the most fashionable audience in Dublin, to use a word indicating an essential item of female attire, which the lady probably would never utter in ordinary circumstances, even to herself.
Right, yeah, of course she wouldn't refer to her underwear.
Sarah Allgood, yeah, has no linguistic frame of reference for her undergarments. Clearly, like, cannot even conceptualize. But that, I mean, that's a reference to a point in the play. So Sarah Allgood played Widow Quinn.
Yes, because she talks about sewing a shift, doesn't she?
Yeah, so in Act Two, whenever she's putting the moves on Christy, and he's sort of saying like, you know, well, what would I be doing if I were to go with you? She says, I'd be doing like myself. I'm thinking when I did my straw in my mouth. Well, she says she shouldn't stay with Pigging because she'll murder her. So she's like, you'd be doing like myself. I'm thinking when I did destroy my man. From above, many's the day, odd times and great spirits, broad in the sunshine, darning a stocking or stitching the shift, and odd times again, looking out for the scoot, blah blah blah. So in the midst of this, again, you know, kind of murderess trying to seduce murderer moment, there's this, you know, kind of just passing reference to undergarments, which apparently should not even belong in the vocabulary of an Irish woman.
Of the people who wear them, they shouldn't even know what those things are.
but I suppose I think also what that does get at is the sense that, like, there's something about, but you made an Irish woman say that word out loud
publicly.
In public.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so the question of like what happens when things are put on stage is a big kind of issue for the riots. But also for the play itself, right? There's a lot of, you know, kind of readings of this play critically where people talk about how it's, you know, it's all about the construction of an Irish audience, or like what that means. And, you know, it's not for nothing that the play is consistently structured around Christy kind of selling a different story of himself to a receptive audience, or like tale, you know, and then how, you know, as I was saying, the play seems to kind of anticipate its own reception, like the point at which it stages the thing it's about.
Yeah.
It's on stage audience try to like close down what's happening. And then that prompts the offstage, you know, it's not for nothing that you know, Ben Levitas calls it a sort of hall of mirrors.
I suppose for me, the crime aspect really struck me when I watched it, that the Widow Quinn, they keep talking about her destroying her man. And I'm like, no one complained about this at all when they were writing in letters and saying how awful the play was. They all said that Christy killed his dad, but nobody said that the Widow Quinn killed her husband. And everyone knows, and everyone seems fine with it, apart from slagging her off. No one turned her over to the police. Nothing happened. It's like, what? And in the complaints about the play, they're like, how dare you suggest that Irish people would tolerate criminality? We are well known for A, not being criminal, and B, hating criminals. You're like, but okay, the thing, you're only complaining about half of the crime in the play. And also historically, you know, you could say within the colonial context in particular, a lot of people in the society are quite relaxed about breaking rules as long as you have a good reason to break them and it's a communally accepted reason. And what's the commonly accepted reason for the Widow Quinn killing her husband? No one tells us.
Well, I mean, you know, apparently she like nicked him with a shovel and it seems to have given him tetanus or something. You know, it's a, but it, yeah.
It was an accident.
No, but I mean, you're completely right that, and I mean, if we look at the like response to the play, as you say, one of the things that's, that obviously provokes scandal is A, the fact that the parricide in itself, the kind of joyous, like the exultation with which it's greeted, particularly the kind of sexual exultation that it receives among the play's female cast, you know, and like the play gets some really funny kind of moments out of that. Like whenever the minute Christie basically mentions he's killed his dad, they're like, right, we need to employ this man. Like yeah. he's our pot boy. So, you know, Piggeen says, ah, that'd be a lad with a sense of Solomon to have for a potboy, Michael James. You know, Piggeen, she talks about if I'd let that lad in the house, I wouldn't be fearing the loose khaki cutthroats of the Walking Dead. And whenever Christie's like asked if he shot his father, he's like, no.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I don't have a license for a weapon. I'm a law-fearing man.
Right. Yes, of course you are.
So, you know, the play is, again, very much in on the joke about its own kind of engagement. But as you say, I think one of the things that kind of animates this is an awareness that, particularly in the kind of British cultural imaginary, the Irish are basically by this point synonymous with criminality, right?
Mm. Hooligans. Yeah. Riots, the whole shebang.
Moonlighting, the Phoenix Park murders, you know, you name it. There's, and the figure of, you know, I mean, Parnellism, as it was presented in the English popular press, was very much framed as just a sanction for kind of criminal violence and this sort of total breakdown of law and order. So, yeah, there's this sense that having an Irish community welcome and conceal a criminal is only serving to like sanction these kind of hibernophobic caricatures. I mean, Singh obviously has the kind of last word on this, in that he's just like, well, this is just based on something that I was told on Aaron.
Happened already, lads.
They sheltered a murderer and you know, happily tried to kind of get him away to America, you know, so it's just fact. And you know, and if you look at the, you know, his notebooks from his time on Aaron, he you can see where that story originates, and you can see it captures his kind of imagination. But yeah, no, I mean, again, it's not clear whether the Widow Quinn's criminality is sort of overlooked out of whether that's a kind of form of decorum, like they don't even want to further intensify the slander on Irish womanhood, or they just miss it. Or they're too worked up about other things.
There's so much to get worked up about. There just isn't time to accommodate all their criticisms.
I mean, she's described as like a coarse virago by that Western girl we've quoted, or notional Western girl, I think. But yeah, so it's a play. Yeah, that's definitely kind of concerned with crime and like crime's proximity to like sex as well, and violence,
and that crime can be sexy, very sexy.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, and again, the play has so much fun. Like, the kind of curtain line for Act One is like, Asher shouldn't have killed my father before. Like, you know, if I'd known I was going to get this response.
If I'd known I was going to turn into the local stud, I would have done this years ago.
Begin's dad is like, you know, you expect me to welcome this father slayer into my family? I'm not going to become his father-in-law. That's a dangerous position. This guy's got a taste for it now.
Oh, God. I mean, it is both very silly and very clever at the same time. And it performs an amazing trick, I think, like that, the way it just catches you and you laugh at it. And then you go, oh, actually, if you think about it, that's quite interesting how it ties back into so much else. And that's the play itself, which was unexpectedly, cleverly offensive. Singh included some pretty disgusting images, from breastfeeding lambs for the bishop's table to Christie potentially marrying his wet nurse. I wonder if these moments were too awful or too quick to register with critics, who preferred to talk about crime and underwear instead. So the next episode will be on the riots themselves, documenting the wildest week in Irish theatre history. There was rowdy singing, police arrests, and a patronising speech by W.B. Yeats. This had everything. Till then, keep your hands clean and your minds filthy.